You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'm the president and founder of the California Rock Art Foundation. And what we do is we identify, evaluate, manage, and conserve rock art both in Alta California and in Baja California. We conduct field trips, we have trainings, exercise, we do research, and in every way possible, we try to preserve, protect, and coordinate treasures of Alta and Baja California rock art, of which there are many and diverse. We also work closely with Native Americans and partner with them to recognize and protect sacred sites. So for more info about the fabulous California Rock Art Foundation, you can go to carockart.org. Also, I'm open to give me a call, 805-312-2261. We would welcome sponsorship or underwriting, helping us to defray the costs of our podcasts, and also membership in California Rock Art Foundation. And of course, donations, since we are a 501c3 nonprofit scientific and educational corporation. God bless everyone out there in podcast land.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, for episode 125. We're blessed and honored to have Tony Precus, all the way from Albuquerque, New Mexico, talking about the remarkable petroglyphs that he has been associated with for quite a while, and quite an elaborate set of imagery. Tony, are you with us?
Thank you, Alan. Yes, I am.
So, Tony, we usually open up the first segment and we let people talk about kind of who they are and their background and why the heck they have an interest in rock art. So you hail from the East Coast originally, no?
Originally, yes. I moved to New Mexico in 1992.
Okay.
And started to explore the state and took some classes at UNM and community college, archaeology and anthropology classes and cultural studies courses, and just became more interested and started hiking out and exploring.
Sounds like you're passionately and enthusiastically interested in both the anthropology, archaeology, and rock art. Now you have some rock art right nearby, don't you?
I'm right on the border of the National Monument, the Petroglyph National Monument. It's down the block.
And what's that all about? What is Petroglyph National Monument, for those that don't know? It's in New Mexico, correct?
Yes, it's in Albuquerque. It's actually within the city, west of the Rio Grande.
Okay.
But there's an escarpment, a salt escarpment, that's 14 miles long.
Okay.
Stretch of the west side of Albuquerque. And There's petroglyphs on the patinaed basalt.
I see.
All along the escarpment. I'm near Rinconada Canyon, where I was also a docent hiking along the trail.
You were a docent there, people. Huh? Yeah.
Yes.
So about how many images of rock art are there? You sent me a few and I was absolutely overwhelmed by the elaborate nature and the number of images just on one little panel.
Oh, the panels that I had emailed you are mostly the Rio Puerco. Those are actually sandstone.
Okay.
I emailed Petroglyph for Chris's sake, because Chris had mentioned in the past episode that he was wondering about if there were any mastodon type of petroglyphs around.
Yes.
And I heard that. I emailed him a panel that I just recently came across. Obviously, it's not that old, but it does resemble that. Most of my petroglyphs that I forwarded to you come from the Rio Puerco Basin, or the Rio Puerco Valley. It's about 30 miles northwest of Albuquerque as the crow flies, but about 92 miles or so going around the various different properties and reservations. And
What are the historic Native people that live there today? What groups are there? Are they the Navajo? Are they the Pueblo? What groups are there?
Yeah, this Rio Puerco Valley is surrounded by Zia Pueblo and Jemez Pueblo,
okay,
along with the Navajo Reservation. It's kind of centered. It's very close to Guadalupe Ruin.
Okay.
Or ruins.
So what you've got there is a whole group of Pueblo Indians and also that are agriculturalists, correct? And a couple of different linguistic groups, because I know the Navajo are recent, migrants into that area.
Correct.
Although they're
Athabascan.
Right. But their religious lore and their imagery is damn close to the Pueblos, and a lot of what I see there, bespeaks the very rich and complex cosmology of the Pueblo Indians. Would you agree?
Yes. Yes. They're intertwined at this point.
Yeah.
Historically.
Yeah. Right.
But also prior to the Guadalupe, did you know that the Guadalupe ruin I spoke of, it's a mesotop ruin. It's actually the easternmost Chacoan outlier.
Oh, wow.
It's around 4 miles from these petroglyphs. So
we
were looking at some sort of influence there as well. That Pueblo on top of the ruin has a 39 room.
Right. Yeah. And what they've learned more and more about Chaco is that it was just an amazing
center,
sort of a mini civilization with roads and expressions and tremendous amounts of architecture, and just a mini civilization was going on there. And
it was a centerpiece,
a very elaborate and religiously complex. And we've got the archaeoastronomy with there and everything else happening. It's a cosmological and very sophisticated culture. Yeah, Chaco's amazing.
Right.
And that's interesting to have that in that particular expression. So why did you gravitate to Native American studies and archaeology and rock art?
Thinking about this, it was just very interesting and spiritual, and it just became part of my whole experience. Hiking, and you're releasing stress, and you're in the right state of mind, and you come across a petroglyph, and you just it's just a Zen type of moment.
You
have to be in the right state of mind to really view these petroglyphs.
So you really see it as sort of a whole entanglement where you can hike and you can see and enjoy and also discover.
Yeah, it's almost a reward in itself.
So it sounds like it's almost a religious or spiritual experience, correct?
Yes, exactly. It's almost a reward that you found it, you made it. You're here. This is for you.
You know what this brings me back to?
What is that?
It's funny, Tony. Just when you mentioned that. So as a little baby archaeologist, right? When I was a teenager, I'm going to be turning 72 here in July. But when I was in my teens, one of my first jobs was with the California Desert Planning Staff, right? Out of Riverside. And we had the job of documenting the entire California desert and finding out where the most important cultural resources were, including rock art. Can you imagine the entire California
desert? Not a monumental
task.
Not a monumental
and it was,
task.
And it's, and out in the West, of course, most of it is owned by the government, the Bureau of Land Management. So we had freeform, drove around,
That's
found
great.
This place, found that place, and heard about this thing. So, and I was a novice. I was just, I had no background at all, but they drove me out there and we went to this basalt flow and, we're roaming around looking for stuff and trying to find anything. And literally behind me, we found a brand new petroglyph site and it blew my mind. I was literally inside the site, almost on top of it, when I turn around and I'm face to face with this, very elaborate and beautiful glyph. And it just blew me away. it just shocked the hell out of me. And so you reminded me of that experience. It found me and I found it. So,
right.
Well, let's stop it there. That'll be the first segment, and we'll get into some of the details of some of the panels and maybe try to figure some of this out. See you on the flip-flop. Well, welcome back, gang. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, for the second segment of episode 125. And we have Tony Precus from New Mexico talking about some of these wild rock art panels that he sent me. And I was a bit overwhelmed by them. So I'm going to take a simple one here and look at it. So let's look at that first one here, Tony.
Okay.
That one that I talked to you about. Where is that one from? Tell me what you think you know about that panel.
So this is a fringe figure.
Mm-hmm.
With the Adirond pose, as you say. To the right of it is a type of bird. Are we talking about that one?
The only thing that I see on this panel are those two, like, twisty...
Oh, the spirals?
The spirals, yes.
Oh, okay.
I tried to take the simple panel to start because I know that
you
if
did.
You get me started, if you get me started, I could probably talk for hours on this.
Yes. What you can't see over here is that these double spirals, as I call them,
yes,
are kind of inset with the boulder onto the left side of it, kind of jutting out. So they are susceptible to shadow.
Ah.
And in that area of the Rio Parco Valley, Native Americans have their ceremonies on the equinoxes and the solstices. And that area is closed for about a week's time, a little less than a week. And those times correspond to the equinoxes and solstices.
And you're saying that these particular unwinding and winding spirals may be solstice or equinox markers. That is absolutely fabulous. So let's talk
Correct.
About this for a little bit. So I guess the conventional model, conventional meaning, you know, sort of there was a decades and decades of argument back and forth in rock art literature trying to say or insist that the artisans of rock art were exclusively shamans, medicine persons. And that may be the case. I don't have a problem with that. But they were trying to also say that the imagery itself was sort of commemorating altered states of consciousness using either psychotropic plants or other ethnogens, as they call them, to basically, you know, meet the divine or meet the otherworldly and the world of the supernatural, enter into it, and that these would be commemorations of visions. And that may be the case, but I think there's perhaps sometimes a simpler, maybe not simpler, it's not, but sometimes another way of thinking about this. I think that rock art is what they call polysemic or full of compound metaphors.
Correct.
And that when you're looking at these images, you have to think about them at many, many levels simultaneously. Would you agree with that, Tony?
The spirals, absolutely. The spirals have so many different meanings, whether
right.
it be a pool of water, a spring, migration glyphs, and of course,
right.
in this case, maybe something else.
Right. Now, the way I define these spirals or these concentric circles, and this is what I've used in the literature, there's a gentleman that I have as a colleague that I found. I mentioned this to you on our phone call. His name is Bernie Jones, and he actually spent years and years and years in tutelage himself, becoming a shaman with some of the Native Americans themselves. And He stopped that tutelage because he got scared. It became too powerful and too supernatural for his tastes, and felt that he really couldn't continue in this particular scholarly way because it was too powerful. So with that said, when he has defined or identified these spirals or concentric circles or these portal-like elements. He says that they define or they identify these places, these nexuses, these particular windows into the supernatural. These are places that are powerful and they're marked as such. And these are the places where one can enter into the supernatural realm. Places, they're envelopes or connections or particular tethers to other worlds. How am I doing? Does that make sense?
I have heard that they are portals as well.
Right. Now, the reason I say that is they're marked in that way because even if this was a way to do the archaeoastronomy or the particular connection of the light dagger against those images on the equinox of a solstice, that is considered to be a powerful supernatural experience and one that is marked with almost a, how would you put this? It's as though you are re-experiencing the initiation of the world. How's that? It's a phenomenon, an experience, a ritual, a ceremony where you're capturing the cosmic connections, the cosmic ambivalence, the revitalization, the transmogrification of the universe. So in other words, this is a way with many different native groups where they talk about the fire ceremony or the re-inauguration or the ceremony where the world stops for a minute and then we must recharge the universe so it can continue in this realm. Does that make any sense?
And it's powerful, very powerful stuff.
But I can explain it a little bit. Those sound like a whole bunch of words, but I had the opportunity to really experience one of those sites that we're talking about. Call it the Winter Solstice Ceremony Site. How's that? Right?
Where was this?
This was in the far Southern Sierras of California, Eastern California.
Okay.
And there's a painting that shows the sun coming up behind the highest hill, the highest mountain. And if you're there for a sunrise, right, on the winter solstice, right, you get there right at 7:30, December 21st or thereabouts, and you see the sun coming up behind the highest mountain, and it sits there. It sits there and does not move for maybe 30 seconds, maybe a minute, and then it begins to shine and glow. And just that whole sort of experience of seeing the sun do that and knowing where you are and seeing the imagery on the rock, it gives you a whole different feeling, a whole different sense, a whole different set of expectations, a relationship to the sun as a deity, as a being, as a supernaturally charged energetic phenomenon.
And you being one with it all.
Yes, and we being one for it all. Now, what the natives believe, and it makes sense, is during this period of time, you have 2 or 3 days where the sun doesn't move. It sits there in that little spot, right?
Right.
And it doesn't begin to move back the other way. It sort of stays in that little spot. And so as they thought about it, and it makes sense, it was their responsibility to get that sun a moving again and keep it moving in terms of its travels and its relationship to the heavens. And unless they began to sing and dance and conduct the ceremonies that they had done forever, it may not move. And then where would we be?
It might be stuck.
Right, it might be stuck. So they move it along in the heavens, and that's part of the relationship they have with the solar deity. The sun is to them a being, a very energetic being, and they typically have people who are in their particular tribe who are watchers of the sun watchers.
Right.
And
right.
So they track it. And they know where it's going to be, and they know when about it's time for the sun ceremony. See what I mean?
Yep.
And so it really does begin to enervate everything about your being, because you have a new relationship with the cosmos, seeing the sun, understanding its movements, knowing it comes up, seeing it's painted on the rocks. You're there and you're freezing your butt off in the morning, and there comes the sun and all of a sudden everything is enlightened. Everything gets warm, and the sun comes up and sits right on the top, on the very peak of that, the highest peak in the far seven Sierras. And there it shines, and there it comes, and that's one way of looking at it. So that's an archaeo-astronomical site.
Yes, and that must be amazing.
It is amazing. But it's equally amazing in another way, and that is when you can see it as what's called the sun dagger. And so when it shines in a certain way, and it produces a light shaft, a shaft of light, and so we can mark that spot and know pivotally when it's going to be in that fashion. So that's another way of marking, or particularly, you know, sort of connecting with that phenomenon. So I like that. That's kind of a fun thing to know about.
And I always, it doesn't have to be a dagger.
No.
Sometimes it can be the movement of a shadow.
Yes.
Along with the figure,
right.
A figure, or the dance with the figure.
Yes, yes, I love it. Well, so we got through one little piece of the figure in this segment. See you in the flip-flop, gang. Welcome back, gang. This is Dr. Allen. We're going to finish up. This is the third segment on episode 125 with Tony Prekus. And Tony, you're gonna tell us something about that series of intertwining, unwinding circles. You said it's way up on the side of the hillside, right?
Right. This is about 20 feet above the dry wash,
wow.
Which is a tributary of the Rio Puerco. So you have to climb up on this ledge, or it's a mound of rock and dirt, to see these petroglyphs. And I know I bombarded you with a lot of panels, but they're all here on this sandstone mural, on this sandstone ledge, eye level.
Yeah, the canvas is sandstone. It's a beautiful beige.
Right. Very unusual for New Mexico.
And so now that's not the only thing in this panel, of course. We have a very remarkable figure,
right,
that's just to the left of that, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So that figure, it's rather interesting to me because it has some nuances that are kindred to my friends in the Cosos. So as I've said, some people would say, oh, this is only, it's a solid-bodied figure. It's a shaman that's dancing, and, you know, it's one that's commemorating the altered states of consciousness. They're doing they're involved with a vision experience. Well, that's possible. But I think more possible and more highly probable is that that figure is some sort of a supra-mundane being. It's a deity. It's a figure of power. And the reason I say that is because there's a visual shorthand that comes with that figure. What is that?
Well, the lightning bolt, perhaps, at its feet, at its base.
Yeah, that's true. But what I always see is the hands that are astride and the fingers that are wide going up to the cosmos, to the heavens. And for 2,000 years, that has been an adorant posture recognized throughout the world for the last, you know, for 50,000 years. You found it on rock art, but also it's used in Catholic art and in other art as well throughout the world. And it's a visual shorthand having to say that this is adoration, this is prayer, this is supplication. This is also a way of showing that this is a being that is not a conventional being, not a just a regular everyday human being, but this is a powerful spirit, a supramundane kind of an animal human that is a figure of power and prestige and magnitude. And you can see that. It's got...
It hints of flight, doesn't it?
Hints of flight at the bottom. That's either fringe, and that fringe sometimes is called tail feathers. Sometimes it's identified as a feminine element. They even call it pubic fringe, and that's shown. But this one doesn't have any sort of denotation of the actual sex of this figure. But besides the posture and that linear nature, what does it have behind him or her? It's got a very strong serpentine figure. It's a snake. I would say strongly it's a snake. A
serpent, yes.
And the snake has a lot of meanings. It's not a bad thing to a lot of the indigenous people. It was a powerful spirit figure, and it had to do with everlasting life because it sheds its skin. It has to do with water because of its serpentining, you know, way it moves on the ground. It also is a being that's liminal. It lives on the land, but also is under the land. It's considered to be the shamanistic deity that sort of protects and deals with all of the underworld. Sometimes the underworld is an area where the animals go after they're killed, and then there's a shamanistic deity, what's called an animal mistress or animal master, that actually is responsible for bringing back and revitalizing those animals because they're immortal and they don't die, and they come back every spring, and they come out of the holes in the rocks, the springs, the tanks, the ponds, all the different avenues in terms of vortexes and vortices that can express the new life.
Right.
And so that's there too, right?
It is. And it's interestingly drawn behind it, you mentioned.
Yes, behind it.
So it's depth.
Right, right. And then right below it is a lightning arrow.
Right.
What's that all about? Well, that has to do with fertilization. It's going into the ground and into that crack right there at the base. And that, again, is sort of a fertilizing mechanism. Lightning is seen as sort of hitting the ground and then enabling the ground to open up and produce life. Just like a seed is thrown into the ground, right? And dies, it's covered up, just like in death, and then it sprouts anew. So from death comes life. So again, because of the water symbol, because of the lightning arrow symbol, this could be an animal master. It could be partly one of the roles of this particular figure might be as a being that is venerated, and in a way to hope and pray and supplicate and give us long life, give us regeneration, give us water, give us plants, give us animals, and give us life.
Yes.
And all of this in this little figure.
There's only four figures here. Yes. It's so complicated. Yes.
Yes.
And these resemble what I've heard of as way figures, Navajo
yay figures. Yes. And when I talk to my friend, who's a Pueblo Indian and also a Ute Indian, and I asked him about those figures that exist there in Utah and New Mexico, and I said, well, what are all those figures all about? He says, well, those are like yay figures. They're like, these are animal human figures that populate the cosmos and are part of the many, many deities, the multiple deities that exist in the native world.
Right.
Because they're not just one thing. They're men, they're women. They're part of their responsibilities are multifaceted. Hmm. And it's interesting that it has a solid body because they took time to make it solid.
Oh, yeah.
It's interesting that it has some sort of a hat or some sort of a headdress. And it also even has two eyes and a nose, which usually many of these figures have no faces on them, but this one does. So all of that, you know, we could go on and on and on about that, but all of this in just three little elements on one little panel.
Yes. Amazing. And it's actually deeply pecked.
Yes. Yes. That's very important because you can notice that those spirals are very deeply pecked, aren't they?
Right.
And then the animal human figure is almost stretched or etched into this beautiful expression on that sandstone.
Right. And that's relatively recent.
Okay, yes.
Certain petroglyphs on this panel, on this outcropping, look deeper than others. Some are faded, but these are attended to.
Are older. And one of the things that we found, of course, is that the native people go back and look at those images, and the ones that are favored are re-pecked. Yes. They're recharged. Yes. The energy is recharged from those images that they favor so they could bring out the mojo and bring out the energy and bring out the mana from heaven from those favored figures.
Right. Recharged. I do like that.
That doesn't help us when we try to date them,
no.
By the way.
No, it doesn't.
Yes, they recharge. No, but needless to say, it's you can tell that certain figures are rather special.
Yeah, and important to ceremonies.
Yeah. Well, I think we've almost used up our time. What would you say to anybody who listened to this episode? What's your takeaway from this, Tony? What would you tell them by way of recommendation or by way of sort of a reflection on your experiences with Brockhart?
Well, I think I mentioned it earlier about being in the right state of mind. And sometimes they'll find you if you are. But for instance, my dog went and chased a cow fairly close to here. And the first time I was looking for this, and I was just not in the right frame of mind. But after I returned, and I was without my dog, by the way, I was searching for it, and I was at peace, not finding it, and there it was. I saw the panels, and I climbed up. And so being in the right state of mind, basically, to really appreciate this and not taking it lightly. This is a remote area.
And so sometimes these figures are almost a way of meditating or sort of divining and connecting to a higher power, to some sort of the cosmos, and sort of enjoying the natural world, and also understanding that you're connecting with a freeze frame from hundreds and sometimes thousands of years ago, which in of itself is rather supernatural.
Right. I agree.
Well, I think with that, Tony, we're going to say adieu. Thank you for coming to us from New Mexico.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
See you in the flip-flop, gang.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Rachel Roden.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.